Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. You've probably seen the Census Department new income and poverty figures making headlines. And to the surprise of no one, the stubborn unemployment rate is taking its toll, with more people falling below the poverty line last year. That group is the largest it's ever been in the 50-plus years that the Census Bureau has reported the statistic. Minorities and the young were hit hardest, and the median income for men is basically what it was in 1973, adjusted to today's dollars. So not a pretty picture. Joining me is Rachel Black, a policy analyst in the Asset Building Program at the New America Foundation. Rachel, welcome to WNYC.
It's good to be with you.
There are so many stats here, one more interesting than the next, one more troubling than the next. The dramatic uptick in the number of people below the poverty line is simply due to unemployment?
I think a lot of it has to do with unemployment. Certainly, the poverty numbers are based on income, and if you don't have a job, then you also don't have income. Not only are people losing their jobs, but they're also looking for other ways to make ends meet. They could be working fewer hours. They could be working multiple jobs, but not generating the same amount of earnings that they were previously. So I think that we would certainly expect to see the kind of hardship that we saw represented from the numbers that Census released yesterday persist until we can get the unemployment rate down.
And listeners, we want to take your calls on this. If you feel we're talking about you, if you are part of America's what I might call the new poor, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Maybe you're one of those people who long considered yourself middle class and never thought you would ever be poor, and now you're poor. If that's you, give us a call and talk about the experience and maybe what you need to help get it right. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or that statistic for median income for men being unchanged since 1973, we know some people are getting richer at the top of the income scale. We know prices haven't stagnated in real terms since 1973. So what does that statistic mean to you? Were you counting on doing better than your father and you can't? Is it something you're struggling with if you're a young adult male as you start or plan your career? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692 as we talk about these new poverty and wage stagnation stats. Rachel, there are more people now than ever living below the poverty line, but so that we don't exaggerate these statistics, I read that on a percentage basis, it's the same now at 15% as in 1993, and still much lower in terms of the percentage of Americans living in poverty than the early 1960s. Do I have that right?
You can definitely see that trends, really since Census began gathering these numbers in the 60s, has fluctuated, and those fluctuations can be due to shifts in the economy, recessions, or periods of economic growth as we saw in the mid-90s. We can also see that they can be in response to changes in policy with the creation of programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit and the major expansion that took place to help supplement low-wage income. We can
not
see
to mention
that
Medicare and Medicaid.
Absolutely.
1960s
Social
programs.
Security is
well,
the
that goes back to the 30s. But if we're talking about early 60s, mm-hmm. Medicare, health care for the poor, wasn't there a lot more elder poverty than there is now because of Medicare and Medicaid, health care for any poor people?
Absolutely. And you can see that over time, and especially originating in the 60s, that's one area where we've made a significant amount of progress. Poverty isn't just this monolithic number made up of monolithic people.
And the number is, by the way, $22,000 a year for a family of four. So if you make below that and you're a family of four, you are below the poverty line.
That's right? Exactly right.
And how is that calculated? What does that mean?
Sure.
What do we make of that? For people who might be making a lot more money than that and have trouble, there are probably people who think, well, $22,000, okay, that's low, but, you know, it's not like poverty in Africa or India.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that we have a hard time, as you said, wrapping our head around here. I think a lot of people have visions of poverty with kids with distended bellies in Africa, but we know that that's not what poverty or hunger, for that matter, look like in the U.S. But we know that people, especially during the recession, are having a really hard time making ends meet. $22,000, just to put that in perspective, for a mom who's trying to work with a couple of kids, daycare can cost about $16,000 a year. So for two kids, paying for just safe and reliable daycare so she can work and make the income and wages that she needs to support her family can be a huge challenge. So even during times of economic stability before the recession, low-income families were having a really hard time getting from one day to the next. And I think that's something that we're seeing now with the pervasiveness of the poverty numbers. People weren't prepared to lose their job. They weren't prepared to go without income for as long as they have. Even for families higher up the economic ladder, people had too much debt and not enough savings. So this recession has hit everybody hard.
Elizabeth in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I called in because I heard you say, you know, if you feel like you're one of these people, call in. I definitely feel like I am. I'm 25, and I live with my boyfriend, who's in his 30s. And, you know, we want to go ahead and start, you know, a life together and, you know, maybe have a family in the next couple of years. And we just don't see this being able to happen. I work in a sports bar, even though I have a college degree, and my boyfriend is struggling to get a package to be full-time at his job. But they already told him that once they do make him full-time, it's going to actually be a pay cut. Mm. And he already only makes, you know, a certain amount a week that really doesn't cut it. So, you know, we can't even think about, like, you know, getting an engagement ring or anything like that. We're just thinking about making rent every month and trying to save. And you just can't save enough to really, like, start a family the way middle-class people have been able to before.
And what are you thinking of doing about it? Anything like trying to go back to school, but then you'd have to take loans, or you know, what do you talk about with your boyfriend that your options are?
Well, you know, I went to college here in New York for acting, so, and my boyfriend has been a musician for the past few years, did pretty well beforehand, so we started to try to make music together. And I'm writing a screenplay just to try to do my own thing because it's so hard and auditions are so scant right now.
Of course,
and
now
just
a lot of the
audience.
Right. Okay. Now a lot of the audience is saying, "Oh well, there's nothing new about starving artists."
I guess so. Maybe that's true. But you know, my boyfriend doesn't want to be an artist anymore. He's just trying to get a normal job, and you know, that's still that's so he definitely still fits in there.
Thank you. Good luck to you, Elizabeth. Good luck to both
thanks.
Of you. Bye bye. Mary in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Brian. I have been unemployed since March of 2009. I was a project manager in Manhattan, and I made very good money. I have been looking for work ever since, and I am 60 years old. So when I would go for an interview, I would be told, well, I was overqualified, which I interpreted as I was too old. How I work these days in order to continue looking for work is do a lot of volunteer work. Yesterday I worked for the Board of Elections, which I will get paid for. Hopefully I'll be able to work in November. I also served on jury duty, which I sat for a week, so I'll get paid for that. But I network, and I explore every option that I have. I also receive public assistance food stamps, and I do not receive the $215 a month welfare due to New York State would put a lien on my condominium, which I do not want to happen. Mm. I had Medicaid. I reapplied. I was rejected because they wanted to know, they, meaning New York State, wanted to know how I support myself. So I told them I have some savings left, and I have some very good friends and some family members. They don't give me a lot of money, but what they give me is enough to help me pay my bills. So that's my story. And I also wrote to Gerald Nadler in reference to my Medicaid issue. And I am going to his office this week. I wrote to him at the end of August, and I was told he was out of town.
Are you shocked by your own situation? Is this a situation you never anticipated that you would be in, because this is something that happens to other people, and you're surprised that there aren't more, what, either safety net provisions or something else to help a worker like you?
Yes, I was shocked for like a year and a half, and now I'm not shocked anymore. I voted for President Obama. I'm very disappointed. I've gotten to the point where I believe nothing anybody says about jobs because they're not living it. And President Obama has said the same thing since he started campaigning. And I feel sometimes that because I'm a single white woman that, you know, you don't get what you've paid taxes for, you know, as freely as maybe other people.
Mary, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Rachel, that's some story.
It is some story. I think it helps to highlight the both the importance of the safety net during times like these, but also the ways in which the safety net is incredibly frayed and not meeting the needs of people who need it. Mary mentioned that she was receiving food stamps. She's one of about 45 million people who are receiving food stamps right now. It's an important program, but one that requires you in some ways to have such low income and such low savings that you really have to be in desperate straits in order to qualify. I think ideally we would see a system in place where people could qualify for the temporary measures they need until they get back on their feet, especially ones that allowed them to have savings, which is their own self-built safety net, programs like SNAP or food stamps, as it's called. In some cases require you to spend your savings down to $2,000, and people would be much more resilient if the safety net and their own savings were able to sustain them during times of hardship rather than require them to become so poor that it really takes a much higher level of resources to get them back on their feet.
Yeah, I've long thought that the first place where health care reform should have started was extending the Medicare back to age 55 or so, because of people like Mary, because there's so much difficulty getting a decent job if you lose your old job and you're in that age group and Medicare doesn't kick in until 65. And those are the people, of course, need health insurance at that age. So, you know, to me, that's where I would have started. It's not to say it would have been politically feasible, but I think there's such a huge poverty avoidance, benefit to that, that just rolling the Medicare age back to 55 to me would have been a huge, huge, boon to the country. My guest is Rachel Black, a policy analyst in the Asset Building Program at the New America Foundation, as we talk about the new poverty statistics just out. Some of the other particular stats: minorities were harder hit than whites. Blacks living in poverty climbed from 25% of the black population in 2009 to 27% of the black population in 2010, while at the same time it went down for whites. It went up for whites as well, from 9.4 to 9.9. But when you look at those stats side by side, Rachel, a lot of people don't think about this on a day-by-day basis, but the racial disparity is still so incredibly stark. If you have 9.9 or, say, 10% of whites living in poverty, 27% of blacks, and I'm guessing that a lot of that has to do with your specialty, which is asset building, that there just isn't a lot of accumulated asset through inheritance or whatever to fall back on if you lose your job.
Yeah, that is exactly right. About a month or so ago, Pew released a study taking a look at the racial wealth gap and the impact of the recession on household wealth. And it really is staggering to see, one, such low levels of holdings among minorities and the disparity between white households and minority households in terms of the impact of the recession. You can really see that whereas minority households held most of their wealth in their house, white households held most of their wealth in terms of stocks and bonds and their retirement portfolio, which has rebounded almost completely, whereas housing, we can clearly see, is still in a very desperate situation. So more than just the loss of wealth and the disparity between white and minority households, though, is that even going into the recession, minority households, about a quarter had no wealth to begin with.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important place for us to start as we're considering how we get out of this recession, is making sure that people are more resilient and less vulnerable going into the next one. And one way surely to do that is help them to build a pool of resources that they can pull on in case of emergencies.
Of course, that's why the country went down the road of aiming for home ownership for all. But and we see how that wound up. But Jared in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jared.
Hey, I wanted to say, I heard you called the first caller, Elizabeth. You said that she was a starving artist, and that's not too new to the listeners. But what about a starving biologist? I just graduated from Rutgers in May, and I'm lucky enough to find a job. A lot of my friends didn't even find a job yet, but the job is so underpaying. I mean, I look at these statistics online where they say that recent college grads get paid $21 an hour. Where are these people? I mean, I don't see these people anywhere. I wish that I mean, that would be amazing to me. And I'm stuck here getting, just like the second caller, getting money from family and friends just to survive and get food every day.
And you were a science major. So as a biologist, what kind of a job do you hope to get? Because that's not med school. You're not a doctor, but you know biology. So what kind of job does that qualify you for?
That qualifies for lab positions doing research at universities or in industry, those big pharmaceuticals like Merck and whatnot. I'm lucky enough. I found a job at my alma mater. It was I got the job through people that I know. Otherwise, I probably would have never gotten the job. But it is a very low paying job, and it does make it hard to get by. And I don't qualify for food stamps or anything like that because I live in a house where I only rent one of the rooms.
Uh-huh.
And one of the criteria for food stamps is that it includes the entire household's income. So even though I have nothing to do with anybody else in the house, I don't qualify because they still are in the same house.
So you have to live with people as poor as you.
Yes, exactly.
And you know, it's probably no comfort, Jared, but these stats do show that people just out of college are being especially hard hit right now. And the report says that only by living with your parents, I was waiting for the grunt, are 25 to 34-year-olds staying above the poverty line.
I can totally understand that. And I wish I had that option, but my parents are too far from any job I could have gotten.
Thank you for your call. Or, Rachel, by living with their friends. So even though it's a catch-22, because living with your friends reduces your rent and help somebody like Jared maybe tread water above the poverty line, but then he doesn't qualify for food stamps despite his income because he lives in a household that makes, you know, four single people's total income.
Yeah, that's definitely true, and that's something that the numbers showed us, that people are doing the best they can to piece together their own safety net. As Jared said, that you know there are some barriers, especially for single men. Most programs are geared towards supporting families with children. There's some barriers to people who are in need of that type of assistance to getting that. So they're looking for creative ways to make ends meet, and staying with their parents is absolutely one of them.
And we've had no problem, unfortunately, getting caller after caller with their individual stories, despite the fact that in a national context, the Northeast was actually the least hard hit by this rise in poverty of all the regions of the country. So, Rachel, take our last minute and lay out, if you can, what you think would be the top three policy agendas for your group, the New America Foundation, to fight this trend.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the first thing that we need to look at is helping people build up an immediate pool of resources that they can pull on in times of emergencies, whether they're a national economic emergency or an emergency like their car breaking down. It seems as though most households were really unprepared for either of those situations. An attempt to help people build that small little cache of resources is actually being piloted by the city of New York starting around 2008. Save NYC is a program that's helped very low-income households build up savings, and it's something that's being replicated in several cities across the country and something that I think serves as a great model for national policy. Something else that we need to look at is helping individuals be more resilient at times when the economy is losing jobs. And one statistic that we can see from the census poverty numbers is that people who have college degrees are much less likely to be living in poverty. They experience poverty about a third of the rate of the national average, and they tend to maintain their jobs. But low-income kids in particular have a really hard time affording college and end up taking onerous amounts of debt that just end up in the long run hurting their financial well-being. So investing in policies, even starting at birth, that help kids save the amount of money that they need to go to college, it would help them increase their earnings, and it would make the labor force more resilient in times of an economic downturn. And quite frankly, that translates into higher levels of revenue for the federal budget. So this really is a win-win-win for everybody.
Rachel Black, policy analyst in the Asset Building Program at the New America Foundation, talking about the new wage and poverty stats just out yesterday. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, still to come this hour, the history and politics of famine and relief agencies. And Siddhartha Deb goes undercover at a call center in India. Stay with us.